Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning and happy Labor Day to you. You're listening to the show. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. We're glad you can join us today. Coming up this hour, we're taking you down the road of discovery from prehistoric times to the future.
That's right. We're stretching our preconceptions and imaginations with some of our favorite stories on this special presentation of the show.
And to kick us off, let's explore how technology may or may not be making our lives more efficient. From dishwashers that save us time in front of the sink to algorithms that help us quickly find a compatible mate, technology is streamlining our lives, but are we really more productive? Our first guest isn't so sure that the latest and greatest tech is making us more efficient. Edward Tenner is with the Smithsonian Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation. He's also author of the book, The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do. I spoke with him recently and began by asking him how he defines efficiency.
I define efficiency very simply as getting more for less. If we can't get a free lunch, if we can't get something for nothing, then we can get more outputs for the same inputs or use fewer inputs for the same outputs.
And it seems as though that is something that technology is trying to increase, right? Like trying to make everybody work faster and more efficiently and be able to do more in less amount of time.
Well, everybody wants it for different reasons. People who think green, of course, want more sustainability. They want lower carbon emissions. They want more miles per gallon or, if possible, all electric cars that will use energy even more efficiently. So everybody wants efficiency for reasons of their own.
Does it seem as though we're getting it?
Well, in a lot of ways, we are getting it. For example, if you look at miles per gallon in the way cars are driven, or if you look at how convenient it is to order books or groceries or anything else online, life is much more efficient than ever.
It sounds like there's a but, though.
Of course. Well, there's always a catch and there's always a cost. And I'm all for efficiency, but I'm pointing out some of the problems with efficiency and not abandoning the idea of efficiency, but promoting the idea that sometimes lower efficiency in the short run will be good for efficiency in the long run. And conversely, if we become too efficient in the short run, we may be overlooking opportunities to become even more efficient in the long run.
Well, how do you see it that lower efficiency now might be better off down the road?
The great strength of artificial intelligence and big data and algorithms is that they can really detect what have been the most efficient patterns in the recent past, and they can give us more of the same. So they can learn from experience, and they're really terrific at that. The problem is that real efficiency in the long run depends partly on happy accidents. It depends on serendipity. It depends on our peripheral vision. And the problem, for example, of an efficient algorithm that you're using to find the kind of people who've been most successful in an organization is that it will learn very quickly what backgrounds, what personality traits, and so forth have made people most effective. But the problem with that is that the environment is always changing. And if an organization doesn't have enough diversity, and that includes diversity of all kinds, then it probably won't be as responsive to changes in the long run. So you're probably better off having some people who have unusual backgrounds who might not be typical of your most productive employees, but have something else to offer. And they're a kind of insurance policy against change.
It sounds like what you're saying is almost that when people are looking at decisions they're making, they need to really put thought into it and not just try to emulate what somebody else has done or replicate what somebody else has done, but really try to think about what somebody else has done or really think about how that can be applied to themselves as opposed to just really trying to, you know, copy and paste from somebody else.
That's right. That there are quite a few studies that show how intuition, our gut feelings can lead us astray, and they're very right. But there are other studies that show that our intuition can really be a very good check on what automatic pilot is telling us. And speaking of automatic pilot, of course, we've seen what happens when, for example, aircraft companies are trying to build vehicles that are even more efficient in fuel economy and also easy to operate, but they don't take into account unusual circumstances that might be only once in a thousand times or even less often. But if that once in a thousand times is a disaster, then it's really important to have pilots who have the skills and training to be able to respond.
Well, is part of the problem here, do you think, sort of operator error, for lack of a better word, in the sense that we're almost on autopilot ourselves and not really paying attention and not really thinking about what algorithms or what a formula might be telling us?
Well, I think that it's really good to have as much as we have automatic. If you compare the general safety record before and after that kind of automation, there is no doubt that autopilot generally makes things safer, provided that you have two things, provided that you have a redundancy in the system so that one glitch is not going to be fatal, so there is another part of the system that can kick in or that can warn you if something is going to go wrong, and you also need people who have the right training. So the argument in the book is really that artificial intelligence, machine learning, and the kind of skills that people have are really complementary. And instead of saying either or, instead of saying, well, we should go back to the old way or we should kind of press forward with complete automation, I'm saying that something that's really obvious, that there is a really good balance and that it pays for us to explore that balance in our own lives.
All right. Well, Edward, thanks a lot for taking the time to chat. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Edward Tenner with the Smithsonian Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation. His latest book is called The Efficiency Paradox: What Big Data Can't Do.
The words we use to describe and define our world carry greater meaning than we might first realize. Strong men, caring women. Could those descriptors be switched around? Caring men, strong women?
Of course, they could, but a study from the Pew Research Center shows that the words we associate with men and women may not be as fluid as we think. The study looks at how Americans describe what society values and doesn't in each gender.
That's right. They surveyed more than 4,500 Americans and asked them questions like, what traits or characteristics do you think people in our society value most in women? Or what characteristics do you think women should not have? They answered with more than 1,500 unique words, and some clear trends emerged. Traits like strength and ambition are valued highly for men. Compassion and kindness are particularly valued for women. I spoke with Cindy Stritzrethrin, who studies linguistics at Arizona State University, more about it. Pew looked at these two big questions: what traits society values most in men and women, and what traits society says men and women should have, which are two technically different things, right?
Right.
The positive and the negative side of this versus also associations with each gender.
Right.
So let's start with a few examples. So two of the words in this survey that were almost exclusively associated with men and then with women were father for men and then maternal for women, which seems obvious but kind of sets things up. Is this obvious?
Right. I think that's a really good question. So if we value men and women in society, do we value them for who they are as individuals, or do we value them for their roles? And one thing about the term maternal and the term father is that they aren't traits per se. These are roles that are designated that have rights and responsibilities and obligations with them. And if these are the positively valued traits or words that are ascribed to men and women, I think it says a lot then about what we value in a father or in a maternal role.
And makes sense with some of the descriptors that kind of come after this, right? So
yes.
Let's talk about a few of those. So powerful is one that I think is really interesting. Americans are much more likely to use the word powerful in a positive way for men, 67%, than for women. It's actually really negative for women, too. It's 92% associated powerful as a negative trait for women. What does that say to you?
Right. So when you look at power in a dictionary, which I did, part of what it includes is having power over others. And then it says control or influence over people and events. And I got this from the Oxford English Dictionary. And you can have that socially, politically influencing people, and you can also be mighty. Clearly, the word powerful on a daily basis is not indicating women then, if this is a trait that we assign to men. Mm-hmm. So what kind of control or influence do men have over others in society that we value? This makes me think of things that I thought we had gotten away from mm-hmm. in this time period, that women could also exercise powerfulness and being powerful, control over others, influence over others in ways that were also positively valued. But I think it speaks directly to ideas that we know commonly now about women in managerial positions or administrative positions, where they often describe having a difficult time having their voices heard, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And that pattern sort of holds true with a lot of these things. Let's talk about honest. I thought this one was interesting because it doesn't seem gendered to me. But this word was almost 100% positive for men, associated that way. And then for women, it's apparently used more often then. So I wonder, is this maybe because men are, you think, still in positions of trust or in those positions of power more often?
Yeah, I think that's the only way to understand this, is that if we understand men being in positions of power, then we want that power to be honest. But I was also fascinated by the fact that it came up so differently for men and women, the number of times it was uttered. Does that mean then also that we hope men are honest and perhaps we don't think of them as always being as honest as they should, right? Do we say it more because we value it so much and yet maybe we don't feel like it's something that we're seeing on a daily basis in our own lives or whoever answers the survey question?
Yeah. So this study is titled Strong Men, Caring Women, right? And it all seems to show that these language associations that we have really sort of reinforce those gender biases that, yes, I think a lot of us thought we had gotten past.
Yes.
I know I was surprised by a couple of these findings for sure. But my question then, and this is why we're talking to you, obviously, as a linguist, is why does it matter that even if the society has shifted, the language maybe hasn't?
Right. And I think that is really the big question. So I'm going to bring up one more example, and that is the word beautiful, because I was very fascinated by the fact that in the Pew study, it comes up as solely associated with women. And when I first looked up the word, it tells me that it's, you know, possessing attractive harmony of features and figure. And I looked at both the Oxford English Dictionary and the Merriam-Webster. And the Oxford English Dictionary just says connotes femininity, but the Merriam-Webster had a note from the editor, and the editor says that when it's used for physical beauty, it tags on to women only. And when it is associated with, let's say, they give the example of a beautiful couple, it is referring to the elegance of their lives, not to their physical attractiveness. So I think it's also really important to realize that this term beautiful that is placed on women is really about their physical beauty. And that, too, seemed to re-entrench actually old ideas mm-hmm. of beautifulness being placed with women. This idea that this term has actually narrowed over time. So in linguistics, we talk about meaning changing shape over time. Sometimes it widens, sometimes it narrows. In this case, we would say that the word beautiful has narrowed its meaning to be only in the case of physical attractiveness to apply to women, that it can't apply to men. Hmm. And that if you apply it to men, you are applying part of the femininity of beautifulness to that man as well. So that's why it becomes this semantically narrowed word. So yes, have we made a U-turn?
Right.
Rather than progressing toward words being less gender sensitive and more neutral applied to everybody? Or are we now in a period of time where beautiful can only apply to women? And is that an indicator, along with these other words, you listed the word caring, mm-hmm. compassionate also maps onto women. Is this a time when we really are hearkening back to stereotypes of women that are not contemporary, but actually take us back before 1970s? If not before.
Yeah. Do you think, as you study language, do you think that it is sort of a harbinger of these things, like in a way that is maybe less conscious, less obvious than what's in our laws or who we see represent us? Like, is language the underlying truth behind what we all are really thinking?
I'll say two things with regard to that. One is that, yes, I do think that our words give us away. I think it gives away our underlying thoughts, our sort of foundational thinking about issues, we can often figure out ideas that are not overtly expressed in the ways that the words are being used. So yes, I think it might indicate that we actually maybe never changed, right? So rather than a U-turn, maybe it just means we wished we would have changed and we haven't, and now that's becoming apparent. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I would say is that meaning is never stable. And so I'm much more aware now that if I use the word beautiful, I am now wondering, well, what did you understand me to say?
Right.
And you and I may hang out enough that we understand, we come to mutual agreements. We do that with our friends. We spend time with our network, and our network may come to more stable meanings. But as soon as I'm in a classroom or I'm in an airport or I'm on an airplane, I now have to think about the renegotiation of these meanings. And I think that's another place where this study is very interesting. So it represents a very large number of surveys. What does that mean in our small individual networks? Are these the same meanings that people carry, or are we protecting ourselves by hanging out in our networks where the meanings are all the same, and now suddenly we're surprised when we find out other people have other meanings for words like beautiful or compassionate, or that these map on to men and women in vastly different ways than what we might have hoped. We know that when someone was asked, what does society value in women, a large number of people answered, they should be, you know, we value beautiful women.
Mm-hmm.
But then we really want to ask the next question, or I do. I really want to ask the next question is, well, what does a beautiful woman look and sound and act like? So then we begin to really understand, are the meanings actually what the dictionary says? Or were these people formulating a new kind of meaning that's going to inch us in a different direction? And that's always the question, right? Mm-hmm. And will those inches of directional change, whatever direction they go in, will they stay? Will they stick around?
All right. Cindy Strutz-Strethrin is an associate professor in ASU's School of Human Evolution and Social Change. Cindy, thank you so much for coming in to talk about
this.
Thank
you.
And there's lots more to come on this Monday. It's the show. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening on this Labor Day Monday.
We are rediscovering some of our favorite stories this Labor Day, from hard science to the theoretical.
So for our next story, we're taking a rather large step back in time, more kind of like a leap. The story begins with a desert hike. Out on the trail, you'll probably come across animal tracks, lizards, tarantulas, or maybe even something bigger.
But imagine you're hiking in the Grand Canyon and you stumble upon a slab of fallen rock. On it are some odd indentations, like overly baked footprints. That's exactly what happened to a group of hikers on the Bright Angel Trail.
A set of 28 small footprints were discovered on a slab of rock that had fallen from the canyon wall. Turns out that the set of tracks is about 310 million years old, nearly 250 million years before the age of dinosaurs. Dr. Steve Rowland, a professor of geology at UNLV, says the find is remarkable.
In terms of actual vertebrate animals, these are the oldest by far. Nobody's ever found any tracks this low, this old, in the Grand Canyon.
Until now, no reptile tracks have ever been found in this type of rock in the Grand Canyon. Rowland says paleontologists like himself have never bothered to look in that area for ancient animal tracks, since none has ever been found. But he says this discovery is a game changer.
Now that we know there were animals walking around at that time period, now we can look at some other places and see if we can find any additional tracks.
Now, what animal made those tracks is still a mystery. Roland says it's definitely some kind of prehistoric reptilian creature, which was living at the very beginning of the reptile evolution. And he explains how we know that.
It looks like a reptile track. Amphibian tracks tend to have short, stubby little toes, like salamander toes, for example, or toad toes. These are long, skinny toes that look much more reptilian. So I think this is some sort of reptile, but it's extraordinarily early. Just the reptiles were just appearing at the time that this animal was walking around.
Roland says the animal might have looked like some sort of small reptile, but we don't really know without finding the animal's bones. However, we can tell a lot more about an animal's behavior. You can see pictures of those tracks on our website. That's theshow.kjzz.org. Most people don't have jobs where they're able to challenge the status quo or do things that don't fit neatly into a corporate package. And the emotional response could be to throw up your hands and say, forget this, and start looking for another place to work. Or even more dramatically, you could decide to follow your dream.
But there are more practical ways to act, and practical doesn't have to mean boring or by the numbers. It's part of what author and performer Tanya Katan writes about in her book, Creative Trespassing: How to Put the Spark and Joy Back into Your Work and Life. Our co-host Steve Goldstein spoke with her and started by asking what creative trespassing means.
Yeah, it's about sort of sneaking more creativity and imagination into less overtly creative and imaginative spaces like work. So that's sort of the high-level definition of it. And it comes out of the fact that I found myself as a theater person giving talks and workshops in companies and organizations and preaching the good word of creativity. And these are spaces that weren't overtly focused on creativity, and yet the audiences would come up afterwards and almost in hushed tones say, you know, I have my degree in musical theater, or, you know, I side hustle as a graphic designer, I paint on the weekends, or I'm in a band, and I want to do what you're doing. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I think I'm hiring. Yeah, so there was this, I felt like there was a need for people to stop making a separation between creativity and work and actually infuse some of the imagination that we access or reserve for the weekends into our 9-to-5. And then I started really like consciously exploring this working within organizations. So I'd say SMOCA when I was a...
which we would think is a creative organization, but it has probably structural stuff like any place does.
Yeah, this was the cool thing. It was actually, it's a largely corporate structured environment. It has a board of directors and all that kind of stuff. And they hired me to think outside of the box. So they're like, she's an outsider and wild, and we need wild and innovative programs. And then they stuck me in a cubicle. And I was like, this isn't funny. Okay, well, I'm going to mine this little space for opportunities. Instead of seeing limits, I'm going to see what can I play with?
Ultimately, we're all sort of like, hey, I'm going to do that step. Like the people you came up to afterwards. So how did you finally decide, like, you know, I'm going to either kick open the box or I'm going to get in my box and be comfortable.
Yeah, actually, there were a lot of years of feeling like I would never be, quote unquote, successful in a traditional sense because I had like wild parents who didn't work regular jobs. And so like to 2 second versions, my dad was a cabbie in Manhattan full time and then a part time amateur gambler and a sometime day drinker. And my mom was she invented products that other people would invent first. So, you know, a lot of the like the tuxedo shirt, that's mine. The tuxedo t-shirt. Anyway, so I come from a long line of outsiders. So I wasn't quite sure how to fit in or how to kind of plot a map towards a quote unquote successful career. And so I'd stay up late some nights and just look at Indeed. And when they said type in keywords, I'd say lost, help, funny, ? And you know, you can imagine the job opportunities with that list. They were non-existent.
Okay, so let's go back into more specifics about your job at SMOCA. There was an advertisement. They were going to have this new space. They wanted some creative person who was going to do it differently. And then you went ahead and you actually got that job. So how did that ultimately affect where this creative trespassing, all this came from?
So then I come to this organization. They're like, Tanya, be wild. They got outside the box. Come up with cool ideas to bring in new audiences. And I'm like, okay, I will. And then I started to. And people were like, no, you are. And the board of directors were like, she's not working. She's just running around having fun. As if the two are mutually exclusive, like as if work and fun cannot be connected. And I realized that I got more work done when I was more playful and engaging with my colleagues and getting to know them on an interpersonal level, as opposed to like, well, our Q1 goals are due, or, you know, let's talk about the budget. And so my playful approach actually made the work that I did better. And it allowed me, I came in, I was a department and a team of one. It was just me. And I had a budget of half. Of one. And so it allowed me to be really creative. And I formed my own team you know, it wasn't sanctioned, but I'm like, okay, there are a couple of docents who are really nice, and I think they got my back. And there's an AV guy from the theater across the way. Please help me, sir. And you know, and the front desk staff at the museum, and we all formed this team to make these programs happen. Nobody gave me permission. I just took it. And they were wildly successful because they ticked all the boxes of my actual job description.
You're not telling everyone to quit their jobs. You're saying try to find, because it is, I mean, a lot of people will say, even probably the same people came up to you, they're probably saying to themselves, oh, well, okay, Tanya's inspiring. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go chase my dream of whatever it may be, because that's creative. Now, are you saying that people can actually accomplish these goals within, I mean, there are boundaries, we know, but they can find their way around like you did?
Yeah, this is absolutely one of the messages of creative trespassing. Because, you know, I have to say, I think that having a job in many situations is a privilege. And people, we forget that, you know, especially if you're reading like self-help books, it's like, quit your job and pursue your dreams. And then it's like, but I'm not going to pay your rent. You know, like the self-help guru isn't like, yeah, I'm going to throw down some money for lights. No, what I've experienced and what I've talked to other people who are embedded in organizations is that if they kind of throw out the scripts and the rule books in order to serve everyone around them and the mission of the company, they can be wildly creative. And that's what people end up seeing in the world. And also just like on a very, you know, some people are like, I'm an introvert. I do not want to be performing at work like you, Tanya. However, I do want to have more of a sense of joy during 9 to 5. And so throughout the book, I have these things called productive disruptions.
Yeah.
So one of the productive disruptions is called create a job title on purpose. And you write down all the things that you love doing at work that enliven you and those around you and the mission of your job. Then write another column of all the stuff that you need to do, your responsibilities for your job. Pick something from column A and column B, and then come up with the best job title on purpose.
Is this within all of us, do you think?
A lot of what I talk about in the book is self-limiting beliefs, and we all have them. So to answer your question, we're not born with them. Good news, spoiler alert, we can change them because they aren't a part of our DNA. So there are self-limiting beliefs I've heard when embedded in organizations, sort of like, you can't do that, it's not best practices. Well, maybe I don't want to do the best. Maybe I want to do better than the best, or maybe I want to fail so that I learn something, so that I can do the best job. Everybody has a sense of an imagination. We are born with imagination in our bodies. Whether or not you choose to explore that is your choice. However, this book will definitely teach you sort of bite-sized ways to practice being creative in a way that feels comfortable to you. So it's a practice. I mean, honestly, it's like, you know, we talk about practicing medicine, sports figures go to practices. I mean, we, you know, as creative people, we have a practice. We don't just show up and say, I'm awesome and I can solve any problem with my creativity. We practice and we fail and we make mistakes and then we learn. And then we, you know, it's something I refer to as beta testing, which is, you know, in technology. Technology has it right. They're like, okay, beta test. We're going to throw this stuff out there that we think is pretty good to our intended audience. Then we're going to gather feedback from the people we want to use our product. And they're going to be like, that was awesome. We're like, oh, I didn't understand, not user intuitive or whatever. And then they make it better. And then they offer it up again.
Tanya Gitan is the author of Creative Trespassing, How to Put the Spark and Joy Back into Your Work and Life. And Tanya, always good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve Goldstein. I love being in real time with you.
Thanks for listening today. More in a moment as the show continues. Good morning. You're listening to the show. I'm Mark Brody along with Lauren Gilger, and today we're revisiting some of our favorite stories of exploration and discovery. Bertie Gregory has always enjoyed taking photos of wildlife. He was selected as one of the UK's top wildlife photographers under 20. He's been named a National Geographic Young Explorer. When he was in town earlier this year to give a talk about his work, I sat down with him and mentioned that it sounded as though there hasn't really been a time in his life when he hasn't been taking photos of animals.
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, everyone at high school thought I was a bit of a freak, because in any moment of spare time, I'd kind of rush out of whatever I was doing, friends' birthday parties, school class, sports practice, whatever, and go and try and sneak up on the animals that were near to where I lived. So yeah, I just couldn't get enough, totally obsessed.
What is it about photographing wildlife that so appeals to you?
I think that the reason that photographing, when I was growing up, I found so, well, I realized was so powerful was because on the one hand, it was a great way of explaining to my family where on earth I'd been, because I was sneaking off as a 13, 14 year old, and that's pretty weird. But the second reason was also that I realized how excited you could get other people about the things I'd seen. And I found that pretty cool to, you know, there was something I was so passionate about. Using photography, using video was a great way of getting other people excited about what I was excited about. And I thought that was, yeah, pretty cool.
So traditionally, when you see like video of wildlife photographers, you see these people sort of dressed in khaki, you know, laying on the ground or hiding behind something, talking very, very quietly about what they're about to see. Is that kind of what a shoot is like for you?
It depends. I mean, there's two ways of, I mean, with filming wildlife, generally you want to be close and you want to be filming natural behavior. And there's two ways of doing that. One is, as you said, the kind of, I think, the romantic idea that everyone has about filming wildlife, where you're, you know, staked out in a blind for weeks on end. And we definitely do that with very elusive, shy animals. But the other thing that we do is we try and, with some animals, try and habituate them to our presence. So they know that you're there and you're just spending so much time with them that they accept you as part of the environment. And that's really the best way, because then all your encounters are on their terms. They know you're there, they're chilled, and they just go about their lives.
Are there certain types of animals where that's easier to do than others, where they're more accepting of humans being there?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, one of the best places to film certain wildlife is actually around cities or in parks where they're used to seeing people, because people have essentially done the hard work for you. They've done that habituation process, which can take ages and ages. And as you say, with different animals, it takes different amounts of time. So with certain animals, like really small birds, you can habituate them pretty quickly to you hanging around, whereas something like a mountain lion, you know, a big predator, is often more difficult to do that with.
I would think it's also slightly more dangerous to try to do that with, right? Like, if they turn out they don't like you, that's a problem for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's true to an extent. And a question I get asked a lot is, you know, what's the most dangerous encounter, wildlife encounter you've ever had? And it's 100% always with people. They are
really
the most dangerous species on the planet. Yeah, yeah. Anytime I've been in trouble on a shoot, it's because people have done something stupid, basically. You know, wild animals like mountain lions or whatever, yes, they have the potential to be dangerous, but 99 times out of 100, you've got to be pretty unlucky to not have put yourself or have someone else put you in a dangerous situation.
Now, you have been all over the place shooting wildlife. Is there a place that, in your mind anyway, was particularly cool, or a place you were super excited to get to and you got there and it was everything you hoped it would be?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to kind of fulfill a bit of a dream last year for National Geographic when I filmed on the island of South Georgia. Now, this little island is nothing to do with the U.S. state or the Eastern European country. It's actually a British overseas territory. It's a tiny little island, about 100 miles long, 20 miles wide, right at the bottom of the South Atlantic Ocean. And it's part of Antarctica. And it is something, it's like something out of a dream or a movie or whatever, because we took 6 days to sail there in a little 50-foot sailboat and then did a lot of vomiting in buckets. And then at the end of that 6 or 7 day sail, these kind of giant 9,000-foot snow-capped mountains kind of appeared out of the mist, and they come vertically up out of the water. And then if that wasn't epic enough, the island is then covered by one of the highest concentrations of wildlife on the planet. So there's millions of penguins and fur seals and all kinds of seabirds. It's a pretty special place.
Do you find that when you're in a remote place like that, you do your job a little differently than in places where, even if it's not in a park where, you know, animals are used to having people around all the time, where animals have encountered people before?
Well, the funny thing about South Georgia, and one of the reasons that it's so special, is because all of the animals have evolved on the island away from any terrestrial, you know, land-based predators. And that means they have zero fear of people. And so, you know, we were talking about there's two ways of sneaking up on animals. One is to use a blind or to do it on their terms. And because they have no fear of people, you can do it on their terms. So instead of using a big, long zoom lens and being 100, 200 feet away, I can be 10 feet away. And that means you can get really, really intimate with them and get a bit wider so you can see the amazing landscape that they live in.
When you're taking photographs or when you're taking a video, are you trying to consciously teach the viewers about what it is that you're shooting there and doing it in a way that will sort of help them learn something specific about the types of animals you're seeing?
Yeah, totally. I think we have a responsibility when we're making wildlife films to obviously we want to get people excited about wildlife. But yeah, you've got a responsibility to, you know, educate and kind of, it's all well and good showing these animals in this Garden of Eden, but we don't live in a Garden of Eden. You know, we humans are doing really terrible things to wildlife around the world. So it's important that we bring those things up. I mean, I've found that you have to make films primarily entertaining. That's the first and foremost most important thing, because if you don't, and you mention the dreaded C word, you know, conservation, you immediately switch off so many, you know, so much of your viewers, and you're just kind of preaching to the choir. So I found, yes, you've got to make it primarily entertaining, but once you've gripped the viewer, then you've got to kind of, you know, drip feed their subconscious with the important stuff, you know, the threats that these animals face and what we can do as individuals, you know, 10,000 miles away to help this penguin or bobcat or whatever the animal is.
All right. That's wildlife filmmaker and photographer Birdie Gregory. Birdie, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
If you're an avid listener to the show, you might have heard us talk about the Arizona Memory Project. It's like a digital public library, and KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie met the team working to preserve our state's rich past for our future.
One of the things that I think is fascinating that I'm trying to get digitized are these Arizona safety statistics, which is a really odd title for something.
That's Brandi Helowa. She's a discovery librarian with the Arizona Research Library, which houses the Arizona Memory Project. Helowa's flipping through an old newsletter filled with stats about traffic fatalities, hence the name.
And it was published by the Arizona Highway Department from the 50s into the 1970s.
Helowa says this is the kind of stuff genealogists go nuts for because it contains a lot of very specific details.
And it has people's names, where the accident happened, the city it happened in. So on this page, we have in Maricopa County, we've got several different accidents. In here, we have one that was a driver that was killed because his right front tire blew out, lost control. He stuck an embankment. That happened at 6 a.m. in 1965.
And it's one reason why she and her team of volunteers and interns are trying to get these tiny time capsules scanned and uploaded to the Arizona Memory Project.
This is our Zoichel scanner. And so this is what we use for some of our larger documents like maps. We have a lot of the like National Park visitor guides from Arizona. We'll put those on here.
Peter Grant is the assistant administrator at the Arizona Research Library. He says because all of this falls under the state of Arizona,
most of the state agencies are required to share all of their publications with us, which means when they publish something, they're required to give us copies, both print and electronic.
But what about those older documents, like before photocopying was readily available and when carbon paper was a thing? Luckily, government was really good about making copies.
And sometimes we find fourth and fifth and sixth and even more copies of some stuff because they didn't know that in the 40s and 50s that there would be digital copies. And so they tried to preserve as much as they could, which sometimes results in boxes of things that we have 70 copies of.
Helowa says they recycle those extra copies once they've been scanned.
Get this software up and running.
Back at the scanner, Helowa finishes scanning the sadistic newsletter. Optical character recognition software makes a text searchable. Then it gets uploaded and available to anyone for free. The work can be tedious at times, especially if you're scanning, say, a 200-page document.
But just finding these random things that are interesting that the state agencies published. One of the other things that is a favorite item of mine is called La Roca, and it was a newsletter that was published and put together a literary journal.
By and for the inmates of the Arizona State Prison in Florence.
And it's fascinating to read the things that they were writing about back in those days, and the art that they put in there and the poetry and the short stories is really, really cool.
Ryan Airforth is a digital history and maps librarian. He says there's close to 500,000 items on the Memory Project, so making it easy to navigate is important.
So what I'm doing is I'm going to the Arizona Memory Project website. On the homepage, you can see that we sort of like these big buttons. So state government, historic digital newspapers, history and culture, maps, oral histories, photographs.
of people both ordinary and extraordinary, like Josephine Goldwater and Ruth Reinhold, one of the first female pilots in Arizona, and notorious, like Winnie Ruth Judd. There are also photos of places and collections about events, including the deportation of more than 1,000 striking miners to the middle of New Mexico.
We have the Cochise County Clerk of the Superior Court. That one's pretty interesting because they contributed a collection of Bisbee deportation documents. So back in 1917, you have that Bisbee deportation, basically a labor dispute that turned into deporting all the workers.
Air Force says 95 different institutions have contributed materials to the Arizona Memory Project, including the Arizona Historical Society, Charlotte Hall, Arizona Highways, NAU, ASU, U of A, and
Lowell Observatory. They recently contributed a collection that's correspondence between Percival Lowell and A.E. Douglas. And Douglas was actually the one who was doing some site selection. And so this is correspondence between the two of them deciding that Flagstaff would be where they would place the observatory.
For the people in this story, the work is never ending. In fact, there's a vault with hundreds of boxes that have yet to be opened. But within these concrete walls is our history, much of it well known, some yet to be told. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
There will be more in a moment. You're listening to the show.
Labor Day signals that fall is just around the corner, although with our hot and dry summer, it might still feel like it's a ways off.
It sure does. It has been a pretty dry summer so far, the monsoons few and far between. But perhaps a little inspiring music will encourage the rains to come. From our Monsoon Story series, let's revisit the sound of storms.
A monsoon storm brings us an entire soundscape in a flash. From the wind, to the rain, to the clap of lightning and the rumble of thunder. To the hum of cicadas when the rain ends. But as some of you told us, monsoon storms have often crossed paths with a different kind of sound.
Hi, KJZZ. My name is Timothy O'Brien. So I am actually a musical artist.
Timothy called us to share a musical composition he created, inspired by the monsoon storms.
When I think about what a monsoon feels like to me, it feels like the sky is really opening up and speaking and telling a story. And it's an extremely dynamic story.
And for listener Rose French, one monsoon storm gave her chamber ensemble a rude interruption during a recent concert.
And about halfway through, as we're playing this particular piece of music, the thunder and the lightning gets louder and louder, and finally all the power goes out, including the air conditioning.
Ever since, that particular piece of music has always seemed to bring on the rain when they play it.
So, yeah, maybe we should pull it out so we can get some more monsoons this year.
So that leads us to our next monsoon story. This one comes from American classical composer Verdi Groffet. His 1929 Grand Canyon Suite ends with a particular movement called Cloudburst. The Phoenix Symphony performed it last year as part of their centennial celebration of Grand Canyon National Park. And to tell us more about this, I'm going to hand the reins over to the Phoenix Symphony's resident conductor, Matthew Casper.
The interesting thing about Cloudburst, and I think this goes back to the Romantic in Groffet, is that he calls this the Grand Canyon Suite, and the movement before Cloudburst is called Sunset. So he goes through a day at the Grand Canyon. Now, normally that would be the end of the piece. But he adds this cloudburst movement at the end. And the way I kind of think of it, because it starts off in a very almost dreamlike sequence in which we hear, you know, harkenings back to melodies from previous movements, such as the sunrise movement and the on the trail movement, sort of the cowboy theme, but is played in a much different way, very sweetly in the violins. And so it's almost like, you know, after the sun has set, you're camping out at the Grand Canyon and, you know, you're dreaming about what you've done that day. And then it changes. The harmonies change. Everything dissolves into this solo cello. And that takes us out of this dream sequence and moves us into this sort of darker place. And he builds this storm literally from that cello. And it's just starts off with these slowly moving chords. He uses piano glissandi, and he uses real short cymbal crashes and trumpet chords and stuff like that to sort of give the appearance of, you know, random lightning in the distance. And then you feel the raindrops in the strings. The violins start playing really fast pizzicatos. They actually have to play it on two different strings. There's really no melody to this section, but he is so effective at building it. There's one little motive that he has that builds it in the brass. And it's just this motive of sort of impending doom, you know? And it's like when we see a monsoon, when we watch it come in, you can just see that wall of rain or of dust or whatever it happens to be that day coming in. He uses a thunder sheet. He uses a wind machine, sort of stuff that isn't used all the time in orchestras, but was obviously very effective at this point. Takes us through the storm, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and it reaches a climax. And then it dissipates. And there's a couple of flashes of lightning sort of after it dissipates. And then the orchestra builds into sort of this very romantic, very lush rendering of, again, that theme from before in the Grand Canyon. And it's almost as if, you know, the storm has sort of gone away, and but the majesty of the canyon is still there. You know, having been to the Grand Canyon and experienced like what that is, it's one of those places in the world that you hear about, you see pictures of, and you go to it, and some of those places sort of are like, oh, okay, yeah, that's nice. But the Grand Canyon is one of those places that does not disappoint in person. And so that to me was like the first time I saw the Grand Canyon is, you know, it's at that moment that the majesty of what that place is really comes to life.
Wow. Well, on that note, hopefully we will get some rain soon, Mark.
Indeed. Maybe we can try washing our cars again, see if that brings a little bit of precipitation.
I'm definitely going to do it. I hope it works.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.